Welcome, everyone, to Interpreter Insights. I'm Terry Hutchinson. Our discussion topic this evening will be, well, for this episode, I should say, we're recording in the evening, but it'll be the episode, is Becoming Brigham. My special guest is Dan Peterson, the head of the Interpreter Foundation. And let me just start by saying the mission of the Interpreter Foundation is to support the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through scholarship. Now, we make the latest and best scholarship available to you in podcasts, journal articles, books, seminars, films, scripture roundtables, as well as internet presentations. And we invite you to see what the Interpreter has to offer at theinterpreterfoundation.org. If you like the podcast, please subscribe, tell your friends about us, and also remember that the Interpreter Foundation is a 501c3 corporation. So it is a nonprofit corporation, and it is specifically tax deductible when you give your donation. The vast majority of the volunteers to the Interpreter Foundation are literally volunteers. Very few people are paid. And the money goes towards the research and support of the articles and books, etc. Now, also, because the Interpreter Foundation is not owned or controlled by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the comments we make are solely our responsibility. And Dan, I will represent you gratis for anything that you might get in trouble for today.
I have had some run-ins where critics of the church have sued me. I was once a co-defendant briefly with Gordon B. Hinckley. I thought that was great.
What a great honor. Yeah. We'll have to talk about that later in the program. Now, before we begin our podcast, you know, we want to remind you that if you're looking for a fabulous trip this summer or a marvelous family experience or some other kind of gift, join the Interpreter Foundation for a meticulously crafted tour of Great Britain led by Dan Peterson, who's with us for this episode, Chris Fredrickson, and Peter Fagg. Now, they'll be exploring storied LDS church history sites. They'll learn about the missionaries who sacrificed much to preach the gospel in the UK and about those who converted to the church. They'll explore renowned cathedrals, palaces, quaint villages, spectacular locales. They'll participate in local cultural events. And then there will be four memorable days in London, one of the world's great cities. Now, space is limited, so book your reservations now by visiting the Bountiful Travel website. That's bountifultravel.com, or you can call them at 801-453-9444. Again, bountifultravel.com, or call 801-453-9444. And Dan, I guess BYU Religious Studies Center just released a book called Brick by Brick, which is a history, in a sense, of the early church meeting houses there in Great Britain.
Yeah, I saw a notice of that. I haven't seen the book yet. But yeah, it would be interesting. You know, one of the oldest, I think it may be the oldest Latter-day Saint chapel in existence is the Gadfield Elm Chapel in Great Britain, which we will visit, by the way.
Uh-huh.
So still in the ownership of the church.
Yeah. My one of my great friends was a companion of mine in the Canada-Toronto mission 45 years ago, and he's still there. We talk about it, and he's mentioned Gadfield a few times.
Yeah.
So
it's very small, but it belonged to the United Brethren. And then when they all joined the church, they gave the keys to the church leaders and said, it's yours.
I don't know why, but every time I hear stories like that, Dan, it reminds me, in my mission in Toronto, I was up in the northwest corner of Ontario in the Owen Sound area, and our area was very large. And so we would go out every so often and tracked in the outer portions. And one time we were driving through an area and we stopped and we drove past. I had to back up because there was a building with a sign that said the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We had a church building in our area that we didn't even know. It was in the one of the other stakes, and it was completely unassociated with us. And we walked in the chapel. It was open. Nobody was there. I just distinctly remember what an odd feeling that was to be out in the middle of nowhere and find an LDS chapel.
That is funny.
It was there. So anyway, Dan, we've asked you to come on this episode to talk about a new project that the Interpreter Foundation has just started.
Yeah.
The first episode is a video about Brigham Young. The whole series is called Becoming Brigham. Tell us a little about that, if you would.
Yeah, the idea is to look at Brigham Young, his entry into the church, his conversion, his call to the 12, the experiences that that prepared him for that and eventually for church leadership. Also, the rise of the 12 to leadership within the church. They started off as a missionary quorum whose focus was outside the church, not church governance inside, if you will, foreign affairs rather than internal affairs. But gradually that changes, and it changes by design, by Joseph Smith's decisions within his lifetime. So that my argument would be they were positioned to be the legitimate heirs to Joseph when he was killed in 1844, when he and Hiram were killed. And then we talk about Brigham Young's character. We'll talk about some of the issues that often controversial issues that are associated with him. Brigham Young and slavery, Brigham Young and violence, Brigham Young and women, Brigham Young as an oppressive autocrat, you know, that kind of thing, the charges that are made against him. So we'll be looking at his administration as president of the church, Brigham Young and Indian policy, Brigham Young and, well, the Mountain Meadows Massacre. We'll address that. The focus is largely on Brigham. It's not entirely on Brigham, especially in the early years. It's on the 12 as such, the succession crisis in Nauvoo in 1844. You know, we did a film called 6 Days in August that told that story narratively. Now we're offering commentary on it. And we've been really blessed to have all sorts of cooperation from the Church History Department in Salt Lake and other scholars down at BYU. In fact, the church history people have been pushing scholars toward us saying, you've got to interview him, you've got to interview her. It's been wonderful. So we're getting cutting-edge scholarship from people who are, you know, who are the producing scholars on these topics right now, and presenting those interviews. So I think people will enjoy this. I hope they will. And I hope that they'll learn a lot. I have in making this film, or these films, I
Well,
should
you
say.
know, my experience with Brigham Young, and I've talked about this on our other podcasts with my co-hosts. As a young man, I've always really thought highly of Joseph, just shy of worship, I think, as many of us do. And then I thought, well, Brigham, he was a feisty guy. He did all these things. I didn't really appreciate Brigham in the same way. And then I read American Moses by Leonard Arrington. It changed my life in a way. And the main reason it did is because he showed how much Brigham follows in Joseph's footsteps.
Yeah, you say you were dedicated to Joseph. Oh, Brigham was too. Absolutely was. So, and that's one of the striking sort of leitmotifs that emerges from all the interviews we've done and all the work that we've done on him is how loyal he was to Joseph Smith. And not only during Joseph's life.
But even after, I mean,
I
when
mean,
he
his.
died, he said, Joseph, Joseph, Joseph. I just, you know, and so when I think, well, Brigham taught this, Joseph didn't, I said, well, now wait a minute here. I have to reevaluate everything Brigham did in the prism of that. And I guess it was Garrett Dermott who gave us a talk
Oh, yes.
at one of the interpreter birthday parties a few years back.
Sweeter than honey, I think he called it. It was about Brigham's loyalty to Joseph Smith, that hearing Joseph's words was to him sweeter than honey.
Yeah, that was a fantastic talk. My wife loved it. And she had some strong feelings about Brigham too. And then during one of her pregnancies, when she was a young mom, she could really only read during the pregnancies. She read American Moses too, and that was something that really affected her as well. So this first one though, out of the gate, Dan, I have to confess, the title of it really, I'm not going to say it put me off, but it was like, duh. And I think the people you were with in the film kind of had the same impression. But tell me where this idea comes from. I know you don't say that in the film, but I mean, I have not heard this theory before,
Oh,
and
haven't you?
I'm pretty well versed in whatever is going on.
Well, thankfully, it's a small minority. They've even made a couple of films. I haven't seen them. I don't know how many people have. But the argument is that that Brigham Young connived at the assassination of Joseph Smith and used John Taylor and Willard Richards, who were in the cell with Joseph and Hiram, to carry out the assassination. And the reason was so that Joseph and the 12 could usurp their position as leaders of the church And probably the motivation for it, according to these guys, was because they had already introduced plural marriage, and they wanted to go about it openly. So it was to gratify their lusts.
So as to
And
get rid of Joseph so they could openly practice the plural marriage.
And so I remember when I first was hearing it, somebody asked me on Facebook what I thought about it, and I commented that, well, I regretted the fact that the person who was the principal motor behind it, whose name I can't remember right now, blessedly, I said my only regret is that he can't be excommunicated a second time. Well, he saw that and went absolutely ballistic. But
Uh-oh.
I stand by. Boy, if that is not an excommunicable offense, I don't know what is to lift your hand or your heel against the Lord's anointed in that way.
Is it a group that's associated with some of the ones? Now, I have seen a group recently who's trying to say Joseph didn't practice polygamy.
Right. Yeah.
Is
The
that the
larger group.
same?
These people take it to an extreme, but there is a group of polygamy denialists, and as some people call them, and
Yeah, don't they used to be called Reorganites, if I recall.
well, yes, now some of them are members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which is shocking to me. Shocking. So they will say, for example, that Section 132 is a forgery, that that Brigham Young or somebody conspiring with him invented this revelation, then claimed it was Joseph Smith's. And they'll claim things like, well, it doesn't read like Joseph Smith. And by the way, on that, we recently published what to me is a landmark article written by Paul Fields and Steve Densley and Matt Roper and Larry Bassist on the authorship of Section 132.
Well, that was in
It was an interpreter.
in the interpreter. Yeah.
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 And their argument on the basis of historical evidence and statistical word print analysis is that this is definitely not Brigham Young. It's nobody else who's been suggested as an author. This closest stylistic parallels are to the revelations of Joseph Smith, and specifically the revelations of Joseph Smith that came in the early 1830s, which is interesting because the claim is historically that that revelation actually
It was
arrived
written back
early.
then. Yeah.
And it seems the evidence all seems to indicate that. And so to me, that's a serious body blow to the people who want to claim that Joseph wasn't involved with plural marriage. You can argue about all sorts of other things, but if he was associated with Section 132 in its current form,
Yeah.
then he was associated with plural marriage. End of story. That's it.
Well, there's just so much other eyewitness evidence
Yeah.
and all the rest.
This would have to be one of the biggest conspiracies in the history of humanity. All these women claim they were married to him, and people who knew about it and testified about it later on in widely scattered areas before justices of the peace and so on. Come on, conspiracies don't do that well.
Well, yeah. Okay, that helps me place something because I saw something on the social media, Dan, and I don't generally get into the weeds with some of these things.
Yeah.
I've got a lot of other stuff going on in my life, and I remember seeing something from someone saying, "Oh yeah, learn about the true story of Joseph's death or something like that."
Yeah,
And yet,
that's what they're getting
for
at.
people who can be faithful members of the church and yet still buy into
Yeah.
that for me, okay, that tells me where that comes from, and
Yeah.
it explains why this is the episode one coming
Yeah.
right out of the gate.
Yeah, we're taking the most extreme position on Brigham Young and his character, and but it won't all be as sensationalized as that. But that is a pretty wild idea. I just think, to be honest, I think it's nuts, and I don't know of a single reputable, serious historian of the Latter-day Saint movement, believer or not,
I think even
who
the
believes
enemies
that.
of Brigham and people who've
Yeah.
written negative books about Brigham would have a hard time going that
Yeah,
far.
they would. They would. And one of the recurring themes, as I say, is Brigham's loyalty to Joseph. It comes up over and over and over again, in ways that just make it inconceivable to me that Brigham would ever, ever have rebelled against the prophet. He never did.
Yeah. So this project, how many episodes are there going to be?
Well, we started off with the idea that we do about 52, so a year's worth of weekly episodes. But But this cooperation from the Church History Department has been a double-edged sword. They keep pushing people toward us and saying, "Oh, you need to interview this guy and this woman, and this is an interesting topic you ought to discuss." And so we've now thought it might reach 70 to 75 episodes, so about a year and a half.
Okay.
And some of the ones that we initially budgeted a single episode for, there's just so much good material in them that we've thought, well, we can't cut this. Let's make it two episodes, or in a couple of cases, three.
So, who are some of the scholars that we've got coming on? And
Well, we've interviewed Matt Groves, the managing director of the History Department. We've
okay.
interviewed Tom Alexander, who's a famous retired red professor. He held the Red Professorship
His
at BYU.
most readable book is the last one he did for Oklahoma about Brigham.
Yes,
Yeah.
yes.
The
So
rest
we
of them are a
interviewed
little
him.
bit more academic.
They are. They are. We interviewed, and I'm proud of this. We interviewed James Allen, Jim Allen, who passed
Oh,
away after our interview. But we interviewed him about the mission to England, the mission of the 12 to England. He was
Oh,
one of the
yeah.
authors of the book on that.
Yeah, that's a
And
great book.
it's interesting because he was in his mid-90s just about by then, and I wanted to make sure that we got him early because I didn't know how long he'd be around, and it turned out that that was right. He didn't last that much longer. But Jim was really concerned when we interviewed him that he just wouldn't have the stuff at his fingertips. He just didn't know if he'd be articulate enough. And he was wonderful during the interview. It was really a good
Oh,
interview.
that's great.
So
That's great. You kind
I'm
of had
glad that
that
we
with
got
Richard
him.
Anderson, right?
Yes, we got
During the
Richard
first
Anderson.
docudramas, so we'll touch on that later, but
Yeah, one of the things that I really care about is getting some of these people when they're getting up there and I find out they haven't been interviewed. We haven't captured them. I mean, wouldn't you love to have James Talmadge or B.H. Roberts on videotape? I would.
Oh yeah, that'd be great.
So,
Talmadge could be smoking his cigar.
yeah.
At least if that's what the legend says.
Yeah,
I don't
right. So, I just want to make sure some of these people are preserved. Their words and their personalities are preserved on videotape.
know.
So I figured let's get them recorded. We can always edit it and arrange it into proper form later, but I want to get it while we can. Because we'll
Yeah.
kick ourselves if we miss it.
So this, okay, a few years back, well, just recently, Interpreter did 6 Days in August,
Right.
which is the theater version of the story
Yeah.
that we start to tell, Death of Joseph, Succession of Brigham,
Right.
and kind of what happens in between. A few years back, we did Witnesses.
Right. Yeah.
And following that, you did a kind of a docudrama,
Right.
and then you did a series of internet things. This is kind of the same thing, right?
Yeah, we decided that docudramas, this one, it was in two parts, but totaled about 3 hours. We decided that they don't reach the audience and as big an audience as we wanted to reach. And we don't make any money from a docudrama anyway, make precious little from a theatrical film. The LDS theater audience just isn't big enough to really sustain that kind of thing very well. But we thought, well, let's forget about even trying to make any money off of these videos that we're doing now, and let's make them in smaller format, 15, usually 12 to 15 minutes, and put them up online without any pretense of trying to monetize them in any way. We're just going to put them up there. So when I raise money to do it, I tell people, look, this is not an investment. You will not see your money again. This is a donation, and it's tax exempt and all that, but if we make anything back from it, it's going to be plowed right back into making something else. So it's like the perpetual cinematic fund, I suppose.
Yeah, well, that's the thing about Interpreter. We keep getting these wonderful products, whether it's books, articles, anything. And then after a period of time, very short in many cases, the book or chapters start appearing as additional entries in the Interpreter Journal. It just is fascinating till eventually the whole body of work is available to everybody for free.
Yeah, our
Because
goal is to get it out there and available. And I know, I went off quite a few times ago. Well, I've done many of these lectures in Australia, for example, on behalf of the church or on behalf of BYU. You get out to a place like Perth, Western Australia, where they joke about it. It's not the ends of the earth, but you can see the ends of the earth from there. And or they'll say, if you go any further, you're not getting further away from church headquarters. You're getting closer now. But one of the problems there, as I understood it, was that they just couldn't get our books. LDS books were really expensive in Australia because the cost of shipping them would double the cost, and then the tax, the tariff on them, would put them up half again. So they were three times as expensive in Australia, which meant you want to buy a $20 book, it's 60 bucks. And it was just punitive for a lot of them there. So when we started Interpreter, one of the goals was to make these things, the materials we published, as widely available as we can, including electronically, so that if you're in Perth, you're at no disadvantage compared to being in Provo
Oh,
to getting this stuff.
I mean, when I was in the military, I graduated from BYU, went to law school, graduated in 87, immediately went in the military for a 5-year commitment. Now, thankfully, I was in Kansas, and you might say, well, that's not very close. Well, compared to many of the places I could have been in the military, that was very close. So during my leaves, I could visit my parents back here in Utah County and go to BYU and go to the library and go to the store and get the farms materials because the farms materials were just starting to come out. And that was when it was impossible to get stuff like that. You just couldn't. You didn't know what was out. You didn't know what there was. And then it was just.
It is so different now technologically that a person sitting over in Perth or Sydney or Kinshasa or whatever, if he or she wants to, can have access to just about everything we do and instantly and at no charge. So I'm really happy about that.
So speaking of that, we'll digress a little bit. What are the translation services that Interpreter's doing for some of our materials?
We're trying to do some. We have done a little bit with Spanish and Portuguese, for example, with the film. Witnesses, we put that into land and into French because French is a growing language for the church, not in Montreal, not in Paris, but in Africa, and so there's a real appetite for things there in French. So we did get some of that translated. It's something I would like to do more of. It's time intensive, labor intensive, but the church is growing, especially in places, well, French speaking, Portuguese speaking, and Spanish speaking. And I'd like to see us do more of that. If someone out there wants to support it, I would love it.
Well, this is a call for volunteers. So
We
those
need
people listening.
volunteers and we need some funding for that. But a lot of it can be done by volunteers. There are very good people out there, the native speakers and others who have pretty good language ability. And you kind of need both, to have an English speaker who knows French, say, check the translation, make sure that it's accurate. We like both sides of that. But there's a lot of material that we have, and we're sitting on a library of material. We've been publishing nonstop for, well, since August of 2012.
12. Yeah, we're coming up on 14 years this year.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it was one of the things, and I remember you've told this story before, but you thought it would maybe expire after 2 or 3 weeks. At least everybody thought it would.
We were offered some articles to start off with, and we thought, well, let's make a splash, put two or three things out right away, and then we'll regroup and see what we can do after that. We've never had a gap since then.
No, not
Things have
one.
come in every week, and sometimes two and three articles a week. And this is not, it was didn't start as a plan to do that. It's just happened. And we've got a queue now that extends several months out ahead. So
And we've talked to people who've done the articles and the just the background checking, the fact checking, the blind reading,
Right.
all those comments are there, and it's not easy to get into. When
Right.
I've interviewed scholars from other places and they kind of poo-poo the interpreter, if they had to go through what interpreter authors have to go through, they probably wouldn't be published in
No,
many
our peer
instances.
review process is pretty intense and pretty demanding, and we reject a lot of articles.
Including from some surprising names. Now, I'm not one of them. I've not applied yet. I'm working on something. But,
Well, I remember one night going down. I had a neighbor who lived down the street about four or five houses at that time. He's since moved away. He was a faculty member at BYU. He left to go into private industry, but he had submitted something at my invitation to Interpreter. I came down to home teach him. He opened the door and he looked very unhappy. He had just gotten his rejection notice from our peer review committee, and he was wanting to know, why did you reject my paper? I said, did we? I didn't know we had. Because the peer review process is independent of me, and I want it to be. This is not a vanity press.
No.
I don't want it to be a rubber stamp for me. Now, in that case, I thought that their rejection, I would have disagreed with it, but if you want an independent committee, they will sometimes do things
They'll
independently.
be independent. Exactly. Yes, that's right. So, let's go back to Brigham. What are some of the things that we can look forward to in the upcoming episodes?
Well, we're going to talk about we've done interviews on, for example, Brigham Young and slavery. Now, this is an area that particularly interests me. I had learned years ago something that wasn't true. I learned that Brigham Young supported a bill, pushed it through the legislature in Utah Territory in 1852 that legalized slavery in the territory. And I thought, well, oh, darn, that's embarrassing. That's not Brigham Young at his finest. That's Brigham Young as a 19th century man. How unfortunate. Then a book came out by Paul Reeve and Christopher Rich, I think.
Slavery
And
and Zion.
it's, well, no, this one's called This Abominable Slavery. Yeah, and there's another one, Slavery and Zion. And I've read all three of the books that have come out recently on slavery. And it turns out I was completely wrong. And so is almost everybody who's talked about this. This is not a slavery bill. This is, yeah, in fact, here it is. I was just handed a copy. This Abominable Slavery, Race, Religion, and the Battle over Human Bondage in Antebellum, Utah, by Paul Reeve, Christopher Rich, and Lejean Carruth.
Who
And
published that? Was it Utah?
that is published by Oxford University Press.
Oxford, that's right.
Yeah. And they educated me. Boy, I learned a lot from it. It's, if someone's not really interested in this, maybe they wouldn't really get into the book. But for me, it was eye-opening on almost every page. That the bill that was passed in 1852 was not a slave bill. It was a bill to enact servitude, which was a common concept in the United States prior to the Civil War. Many of the leaders of the church, probably Brigham Young himself, had been indentured servants. It's how they learned their trades. And so it made that available to people of black and American Indian backgrounds. But they could not pass that status on to their children, unlike chattel slavery. And it was required that their masters educate them a certain number of months per year. Probably, I'm guessing, at about the same level that American frontier white boys were educated in those days. And the servants had rights. They could appeal to judges about mistreatment and so on. And Brigham Young many times said that he loathed chattel slavery. It is not right to own human flesh, he said. And so this was completely different than the Brigham Young story I'd been told by people who hadn't really read the law.
Well,
And
and people who just, I think in our culture, we just acquire certain kind of assumptions
Yeah,
when we don't read the history. We do it in
right.
American history, we do it in politics, certainly.
Yeah.
And you get a biased view of the world based on a lot of things. And we see it's even worsened now by social media
Yeah.
because the algorithms just give us what we like and they
That's
just
right.
feed into our own perceptions and prejudices. So
That's
I think
right.
a lot of us have had these prejudices against Brigham without really understanding. And one of the things I know you mentioned Lejean Carruth, and I see that
Yes.
her work on transcribing what Brigham actually said paints him in a very different light, much more pastoral, if you
Yes. Yes, and I've talked to Lejean a lot about this. I asked her once, what's the biggest misrepresentation of Brigham Young? And she said, the Journal of Discourses. And because George Watt, for whatever reason, when he transcribed these speeches and then translated them back into English, whenever he faced an interpretive fork in the road, he would always make Brigham look more oppressive, more autocratic, harsher than in fact his own Pittman shorthand showed him to be. And she says, I don't know why he did that. Maybe he admired that. Who
Well, I was
knows?
going to say, I think there was a certain amount during the frontier of being a tough guy. You
Yeah,
stand up
yeah.
to the army. You stand up to the country. There was a, I would think that someone who loved Brigham, at least as he claimed to do, would have wanted to make him appear to be a stronger character than maybe he was. And so you exaggerate the words a little bit.
That may be. I know that one of the sets of interviews that I'm looking forward to, we were told by the historical people in Salt Lake that they had a couple of scholars who were working on a two-volume collection of excuse me, Brigham's pastoral letters to the saints, to ordinary saints. And they said this will put Brigham in a different light than people are accustomed to seeing him in. And I said, they wanted to know, would we be interested? And then I said, I would be thrilled because that's exactly what I want. I said, Brigham could thunder from the pulpit, but when he had people that he was writing to, he was understanding, he was helpful, he was patient, he was trying to help them. And but these letters, they said there are hundreds of them. They're having to select from a large collection, but they said they will really put him in a different light than people are used to. I'm excited about that.
Oh yeah, I wish I had a timeline on that so I'd know when to look for it. But those are the
Well,
kinds of things, I mean.
yes. And so, we're going to be talking about that sort of thing. We're going to be interviewing at some point Rick Turley on the Mount Meadows Massacre. And that's another one where, I think people are beginning to understand now that Brigham did not order the Mountain Meadows Massacre, but there are a lot of people out there who still believe he did. And so Rick and his people have done really wonderful work in showing what really happened. And it doesn't always put the Latter-day Saints in a good light. But it certainly does not incriminate Brigham Young, who was horrified by this. I've always thought, look, guys, even if you imagine that Brigham Young is a monster of cruelty and so on, the Mountain Meadows Massacre was stupid. And nobody's ever accused Brigham of being stupid.
No. I you know, living in St. George for up until recently, I knew a lot of people who knew about the massacre, who knew Juanita Brooks, who knew. And so I had Rick on my program when he wrote the first book about the massacre that came out in 2008. And then I had he and Barbara again a couple of years ago when the second one came out. And when the way the first one ended was just so tragic, where the guy gets the word because Brigham has sent a rider down saying, "Don't do this." And it comes just a day or so late. And the guy just sits in the street and cries.
And says, I think too late, too
Yeah,
late.
it's too late. I just, yeah, that whole thing. And to me, with the support the church gave that project, with Oxford backing it up, I think it really is the definitive thing. But even then, we still have the survivors. And when the second book came out, some of the survivors came and they got together at a meeting in St. George. Rick was there, Barbara was there, and they still are having coming togethers, if you will, that because of this tragedy that occurred. It's just heartrending to think about it, but to think that Brigham actually did it, there's the evidence is not there anymore.
No, it's just not there. And it was against everything he preached, everything he believed, and it was against the interests of the Latter-day Saints. And Brigham was canny. He was savvy. Even assume he's amoral. He wouldn't have done it. But I don't assume he was amoral, and I think the evidence is pretty clearly that he didn't want it to happen, and he was horrified when it did.
So how
And
many
horrified later
episodes?
on when he learned that at first he was told it was the Indians who did it, and then he's eventually told, no,
That
it's not
was,
that simple, and he was horrified at that.
and then his own adopted son is one of the perpetrators.
In
Although
fact,
I think he was acting under orders.
yeah, I think he was. So, but it's an ugly situation, probably the worst blot on the history of the church. And I've always liked a line from Plato where he says that to do wrong is worse than to be wronged. And in this case, we did wrong.
That was a tough one. And they're still talking about it. When I interviewed Rick about that, one of the things he said, in fact, we had him on Interpreter as well as my program in St. George, but he said that when they were putting this program to the First Presidency of the 12, he said they had to be unanimous. And everybody was waiting for it to get to David B. Haight. Because I think it was an uncle or a grandfather or something. And he
Yeah,
said,
Isaac
Elder
Hayes.
Hayes, Isaac Hayes, he said his mother had said, don't ever talk about it,
Oh,
period.
really? Huh.
And so everybody's talking about it. He says in our presentation, we said, we've got to look at all the documents that you've got, all the documents everybody's got. We need to go on a hunt for manuscript sources in all the Western libraries, anywhere we can find anything at all, a scrap of paper. We need to do this. And then when we do it, we need to follow the evidence wherever it goes,
Right.
even if it goes to Brigham Young, whatever it is.
Right.
He said all it took was one negative vote in that meeting. And
Yeah.
when they got to Elder Haight, he told that story of what his mother had said.
Oh,
And
really?
then he said, but I can't do that anymore for the good of the church and for the truth, and the truth needs to come out. And he
Yeah.
supported the project.
Really? Oh, that is interesting. I had not heard that. Well, and it's exactly right. I mean, if you do a cover-up, the cover-up is often worse than the crime. In this case, the crime is pretty horrible, but President Hinckley, as I understand it, was insistent. No, you have to tell the whole truth, whatever, wherever it leads, whoever it implicates. And it implicated Isaac Haight in a really bad way. And yet, to me, one of the interesting things about this is I've always thought I'd actually almost like to give a fireside or a sacrament meeting talk about the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Or if I had the talent, I'd write a tragic play about it. Because what to me is interesting, yes, what happened to the wagon train is horrible. But again, on the idea that doing wrong is worse than suffering wrong, what it did to the saints is terrible. The tragedy that these were in many cases, well, in all cases, I think, not bad people in the conventional sense. They were good people who did a terrible thing. And that is even more interesting in a way than just, well, he did it because that's the kind of guy he is. No, these people did it, but they are not that kind of people. And they lived with it for the rest of their lives, many of them, I guess, in real torments of guilt.
Well, did you read the second volume?
Yes.
Okay. Because that story at the end, when Juanita says the guy wanted to talk to the teacher and then he dies before he can do that, but horrible, horrible endings for all of them that Rick and Barbara described in that book was just I agree. And the people weren't evil. It's weird because for years I practiced law. I had a law office up in Cedar City. And so a lot of people that I would deal with were the old Cedar City people, and those
All right.
names kept cropping up as I learned more about the massacre. Very interesting experience to know you're talking to a descendant of somebody who did some of these things. I mean, you don't blame them, but it just, how's that in your family tree?
Yeah,
How do
what
you
do you do
deal
with
with
that?
that? What do you wrestle with that? I mean, we all have skeletons in our closet. My grandma used to talk about a brother of, not a brother of hers, but one of her cousins or something that was a U.S. Marshal. Well, we found out he was arrested by the U.S. Marshals. You get these family stories and they're lighthearted, as I just described, and then you
Yeah.
get these others that are just so dark.
You can't make anything light out of the Mountain Meadows Massacre.
How many parts do we get in Becoming Brigham on the massacre then?
Well, we haven't filmed all of them or really any of them yet. That's one that we've arranged for a time, I think, with Rick. Not sure who else we'll get. I think we'll get Janice Johnson if we can.
She did another one. We've had her on interpreter.
Yeah. So I can imagine that one turning into two or three easily. We don't want to give anything too much. I mean, the Mountain Meadows Massacre is not the only important thing about Brigham
Oh,
Young, but it's
no.
really
No.
important. And so I'd say two. I'd be surprised if we got it below two and maybe three.
So, is there anybody working on a Brigham Young project now that you're aware of? I mean, I'm sure you're talking to these scholars, they put you in touch with them. What are some of the things that maybe might be in the pipeline?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any single book that is coming out. I know Ron Esplin was working on a book for a long time. I don't know if he still is. He did a piece for us
In
in
the
a
Joseph Smith volume.
yes, which I think is the best treatment ever of the succession
Oh,
crisis, which unfolds there,
I
on
would
which he is
agree.
the premier expert.
We'll have
So,
him. We're going to try and get him on this
oh,
podcast for
good,
sure.
good. He's really good. He knows his stuff, and he makes it. He clarifies it very well. One of the things he said to me in his interview with me was that if you wanted to carry on the program of Joseph Smith in Nauvoo, There was really only one game in town, and that was Brigham and the 12. Every other claimant to the leadership was inclined to jettison all or most or some part of what Joseph was doing, his agenda. There were two principal parts of it at that point. One was finishing the Nauvoo Temple, and the other was abandoning Nauvoo and going westward, seemingly contradictory goals. And a lot of people said, well, that is contradictory. That's stupid. Why are we doing the temple if we're going to leave? And why, if we do the temple, should we leave? And Brigham the 12 said, no, that's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to do it because Joseph told us to do it. It's an illustration of Brigham following the will of Joseph. And we're going to carry out what he said to do. But, you look at people like Sidney Rigdon. Sidney had no great passion about the
Well, he
temple.
was back in Pittsburgh.
Yeah. Well, he eventually came back, but even when he was in Nauvoo, he was hardly involved.
No.
And then, he probably had not received the priesthood keys. I've had people tell me, members of the church, well, I think the Lord can work through wicked people like Brigham Young, and Brigham engineered a coup and inserted himself into the leadership. But the real leader should have been Sidney. And I think, really? Then you would have had a church that had an extra book, the Book of Mormon. Sidney was fond of that. It wouldn't have had priesthood keys. It wouldn't have had temples. Is this really what you want? It wouldn't be the church as we know it today.
No.
So people need to understand that if you, I've said to a few people, look, at that point, if you want Russell Nelson, or now if you want Dallin Oaks, you don't get to keep them and dispense with Brigham. It just doesn't work.
There's the direct line.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's back up a minute. This is a follow-on from the witnesses.
Yeah.
So Dan, you and a group of a few other people founded Interpreter back in 2012.
Right.
Okay. The story about how that came about, we don't need to get into. A lot of just things that you would look at historically and go, did that really happen?
Yeah.
And yet, the more I'm involved, I got involved with Interpreter back in 2018, and I've followed it almost since its inception because I thought, this is great. I get these articles that I used to have to get from Farms. Now I get them from Interpreter, and they're free. They just
Yeah.
pop up on my email. This is
Yeah.
awesome. Well, then, of course, I saw you had a radio thing, and I got kind of involved doing the radio show and now the podcasts.
Yeah.
But I look at the sprawling entity that the Interpreter Foundation has become, and I think,
Yes.
did all this come from Dan Peterson's brain?
No, not all of it. I've been really fortunate in having a bunch of people come together with me who've done marvelous things. I mean, Martin Tanner was the one who called me and said, "How would Interpreter like to have a radio show?" And she had never thought of it. But I said, "Well, how much would it cost us?" Well, it was at that point free. And I said, "Well,
Free.
why
Well,
wouldn't
why
we want
wouldn't
it?"
we? Yeah,
I
exactly.
thought, okay, look, even if we don't get a very big audience, let's assume that we get the audience about, the size of a steak fireside, a mediocre one. Wouldn't we do a steak fireside if we were invited? Well, if we can do that every week via the radio, where's the downside? And the idea is to get the word out in every way we can. And so one of the reasons we're doing films, I know a lot of people don't read books, okay? We'll reach them where they are. And if they want to listen to a podcast, we'll reach them there if we can, whatever we need to do to get the news out there. So it has been really amazing to get a group of people together who are willing to do this. And for the most part, without getting much credit for it, I'm kind of in some ways, a public face for it. But in fact, I've always tried to make it clear to people that when they'll say, Dan Peterson did this, Dan Peterson did that. No, the Interpretive Foundation did this and
Yes,
that.
they did
It's
that.
not
And
me doing everything.
I know because there's a whole bunch of other board members, and
Yeah.
we're going to have some of them on the program.
Good.
But what drove this desire for the foundation?
Well, I'll tell you a little bit of personal history. This is rather weird, I suppose. I had my patriarchal blessing when I was quite young. I couldn't drive. I had to be driven to the patriarch's house and that sort of thing. And he was a man. I grew up in a marginally active family. My mother was marginally active. My father was a non-member at that time. But I decided I needed to get my patriarchal blessing. And the patriarch, whom I had never met before, as far as I know, and never encountered again, Said something interesting, a lot of interesting things, my patriarchal blessing. One of the things he said was, well, he talked about my traveling around the world, which has certainly been true. But he also said that I would be looked up to and respected for my willingness to defend the faith. And I thought, now that's interesting because he didn't know me, and I don't think I was doing anything like that when I was 15. And yet it's turned out to be more or less true. And in fact, I would say, he wasn't wholly truthful. He could have said, "You will be looked up to and respected, also condemned, vilified, and mocked." He didn't mention that part of it for your willingness to defend the faith. But my wife will say, "Look, one of the reasons I allow you to spend so much time on this is I've read your patriarchal blessing. I think this is what you're supposed to be doing."
I have a similar thing with running for elected office.
Really?
I was on the local school board, my patriarchal blessing, which I got, I think I was 17, 18, said, you have civic leadership in you. And so here I am, and now we're going again on a much bigger stage for, so it happens. I happen to be holding Dan steadfast in defense of faith, which is Essays in Your Honor. And the very first one out of the gate is from one of my co-hosts, John Gee, about the covenantal obligation to defend the faith. And you have taken that quite literally, I should say.
Every time I hear that covenant and repeat that covenant, I think, yeah. I hear people sometimes who say, we have no obligation to do that. We're not supposed to be out there. Yes, we are, in whatever capacity we can be. And I would feel that I was deserting my post if I didn't do it. So.
So I've met you a few times. We're not close. I'm just one of the volunteers. I have a great admiration for you, but I have to confess, my favorite experiences with you have been in your writings. And one of the first that really got me, I still laugh at it and love to look back at it today, from 1992, in the Farms Review, Volume 4, right after the Korihor's back and he's got a printing press incident. And that's one of the lawsuits I think you were kind of involved in, or at least the threats of a lawsuit. I don't know, did that ever get to a lawsuit?
George G. Smith threatened us with lawsuits, but he never followed through. That was not one of the ones that got very far. Although, at one point, my wife found this out. And she was really mad. I guess I just have a belligerent streak in me, or I'm defiant. I got a note from someone, one of their lawyers or someone, saying that he was going to come after me. So I wrote a note to George G. Smith and said, "Here's my address. You'll know where to reach me.
Serve
I'm
me.
not backing away." And they were mad about some of the things that we'd published. The Korihor's back, and this time he's got a printing press line made signature books, really angry. So I spoke with my friend Jim Gordon. You may know that name. He was a professor at BYU.
I had him for some stuff. He's a great lecturer.
Jim's in my ward. Great guy, great sense of humor. But I asked him, what are the limits of things you can say? Well, he gave me a bunch of really good examples of a case where, for example, someone was being sued because he had called someone else I don't know, a something or other who had slimed up from the swamp, and he was sued over that, and the judge said, "Well, you've provided no evidence that you have not slimed up from the swamp, and so I'm dismissing the case." I mean, and the fact is that, within public polemical speech, there's quite a bit of leeway given to people to be funny. I don't like to be brutal. I have that reputation. That's not me.
No.
But I do like to have a little fun when I'm doing this sort of thing. And so, yeah, I mean, there were some interesting times with the review.
Have we had anything like that from Interpreter?
Not really. And maybe I've gotten older. I don't know what it is. And some of the people involved are maybe not quite so into that sort of thing as we were when we were young'uns at farms. And because I would publish satirical reviews of
No, that
books that
was
were just
one of my
awful.
favorites. I'd get the review and I'd go to Dan Peterson's thing to see what obscure piece of anti-Mormon literature you were making fun of and mocking.
Well,
in a positive way. And I had
yeah.
the same thing on my radio program for a
Yeah.
long time. I would do an April Fool's Day review, or I would have fun excoriating some kind of a real negative, poorly written, whatever book. I
Yeah.
eventually got away from it because A, that takes more time than to do a
Right.
positive review, and
Right.
B, there's just too many books and so
Yeah.
little time, literally, when you're doing a review every day.
Well,
But
part of the reason
I
we got
think we
away from it.
mellow.
Yeah, we do. And but you know, I might still be inclined to do it with certain kinds of writing, but we don't review evangelical anti-Mormon stuff
No.
much anymore. And that was always such a ripe target. I mean, it just, you know, these books were born with a kick me sign on their rear ends. And I just felt I had to do it. I mean, duty calls. I need to say something about this.
I have to
Yeah.
kick this bad book.
Yeah. So, you know, but things, bad books by, well, certain, I won't say anti-Mormon writers, but skeptical writers and so on, they're not as funny,
No,
you
no.
know, and they take a more serious tone. And so we take it when we respond to them. But, you know, sometimes these things have just been so ludicrous that you just, it wouldn't do to take them seriously. It would give them too much credit. So.
Yeah. So anyway, those are the kinds of things, and yet you take a lot of heat from that.
Yeah.
And yet
Yeah.
I have to tell you that talking to Don Bradley once
Yeah.
about you, he got very emotional.
Did he?
Yes. And he said that even though he had been against you and had said some very public and negative things about you, you had been very kind at a moment when he needed to be, when it surprised him. That
Yeah.
the real Dan Peterson was not this
Yeah.
dark figure from the, what do you call it, the Peterson Obsession Board,
Yeah. Yeah.
but just a very generous, charitable, loving individual who, even though you had been hurt by this, you really turned the other cheek.
Well,
And that to me was very impressive when somebody who is completely independent, really, from interpreter or anything else, has said something like that.
right.
It's a side of you that we don't see, and a lot of people don't get to see either.
Well, you know, the side that they see often is the polemical side or the critical
For
side,
sure.
responding to attacks and so on and so forth. But, you know, the image they've conjured up on what I call the Peterson Obsession Board, one person in particular, it's an article of faith with him and some of his followers that I have anger management problems, that I'm motivated largely by greed, not greed, by rage and resentment, greed too. And that I'm just kind of in a perpetual state of fury. I'm just waiting to erupt. And I think, you know, I'm kind of a type B personality. I just, that isn't me at all. I think there are lots of things I could tell you about that are flaws in my character, but those are not.
Well, we're going to interview your wife sometime and get the flaws, okay? How about that?
Right.
So,
Get the real truth.
look, I do know what pushes your buttons, and you just told us what it was. It's if a really bad anti-Mormon book comes out that says, "Kick me,"
Yeah.
that's what you're waiting to pounce on.
Yeah. My wife gave me a cartoon once that she found where it showed some fellow sitting down at his computer in the basement, probably, and his wife is calling him to dinner, and he says, "Wait a minute, somebody is wrong on the internet."
Exactly. Exactly. Actually, he's going to bed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes
So,
we
you
can do
know,
that. It's.
and the fact is that I can get sucked into a discussion. I remember once going to the Kimura pageant, the one and only time I ever went to it, and I had vowed, I knew that it was ringed with anti-Mormons, and I'd vowed to myself, I am not going to get involved with them. I'm going to sail right past them. I'm going to have a good evening tonight with my wife and my children. Well, we're walking in, and there were some anti-Mormons ringing the place. And one of them, a couple of them, had a pair of young LDS guys kind of cornered. They looked like pre-mission age, and they were just really hammering them over a point where I thought, but I know the answer to that. I can answer that. So, oh, I'm going to go over and I'm going to help out. Well, pretty soon I was involved, and the two young guys moved away. And there I am dealing with these two really nasty anti-Mormons. One was a fellow now passed away, had a reputation of being nasty. He was an apostate. John Farkas was his name. Published a book or two, I think. But anyway, he was just insulting and nasty. And By the time I got to the pageant and sat down, the steam was coming out of my ears, which normally I don't get angry, but he was so nasty. And so it kind of damaged the pageant for me. And I thought, dang, why did I allow myself to get into that?
Well, on the other hand, if you hadn't, those young boys might have continued to be bullied.
Yes, they might have been. And he was bullying them, very clearly was.
So tell us really quick, summing up, what do we see in the future for Interpreter?
Well, you've already mentioned translations. I'd like to do more of that. We're currently debating whether we'd ever want to do another film. My wife says, oh, it's so hard raising money for it, which is something I hate doing, but have to do if I'm going to do these. So we've talked about that. We don't have a project in mind yet, but we kind of have liked the process and thought we were doing something worthwhile. We want to keep things going the way they are in some respects. I mean, the journal has been the constant drumbeat of our operation. We have not missed a single week since August 2012 when it was founded. Someday maybe we'll have to, but it hasn't come yet and doesn't seem to be in the offing.
Yeah, well, it's several months out if it is.
Right. And I've told people, look, whatever else we do, that's the thing we will not give up. That's our basic reason to exist. I remember Noel Reynolds saying to me once, that's the unique thing, the thing that Interpreter does, nobody else does. BYU Studies will publish an occasional article about the scriptures and so on, an occasional article about LDS history. But Interpreter is the only group that publishes week after week after week after week articles about the scriptures, about the temple, about things like that. And so that's our unique contribution, I think. Beyond that, there's more that we could do to expand. I mean, this podcast that you're doing now is something that we've wanted to do. We've thought of doing more short features, getting more into social media and so on. But you need some expertise there, and you need, frankly, some younger sensibilities than I am, because that's not my world. And I'm willing to supply material if they'll tell me what how I need to sit and what how long I need
Yeah,
to speak.
exactly. It
But
keeps changing. The landscape keeps changing.
And I just that's not me. And I at a certain point, I don't even want to learn it. I've got too many other things I've got to do in the limited time I have left. So I'm not going to sit down and read books about social media or, spend a lot of time on that. So we could always use more people who can help out with that. And another big challenge is simply getting the word out. I run into people all the time who've never heard of us. They've never heard of the movies. And these are the kinds of people who I think would be our core audience. These would be people who would really like it if they were to see it, but they haven't heard about it. So that can be frustrating. But that was even true with the old farms. And we had BYU behind us there. But I remember a case where, and John Gee will remember this, I think, I ran into a couple in one of the markets, local markets, Reams, I think, that's no longer here. But
I remember the one.
they were going to leave the church because they'd lost their faith in the church over the Book of Abraham. And I started talking with them about why, and it turned out it was easy, soft, slow pitch softball stuff. I said, have you heard of farms? No. They were in our backyard. I said, can I put you in touch with somebody? I put him in touch with John Gee. My understanding is that a few weeks later, they were fine.
They're
It
fine.
all been solved for them. And so I'm thinking, well, if we're not reaching people in our backyard, what about people who are way out there on the fringes of the church who don't hear about us? We've got to get the word out there. So that's why podcasts to me are so important, that they can travel instantly and for free, essentially, to anywhere in the world, anyone who wants to watch them, and are, making our material available. In some ways, the old farms was founded a little too early, because when all this technology came along to enable us to do what we're doing, farms was already, well, under the leadership that assumed control,
Well, yeah, with
pretty
that's,
hidebound.
yeah.
But we were able to transform ourselves, to start ourselves as a kind of online organization from the beginning.
Well, one of the things about podcasts that's difficult is it's so easy to mislead people. You don't have to justify anything you say. There's no footnotes, there's no verification, there's none of that. So one of the things I think that we want to do with this one is to introduce people and then encourage them to go look at it themselves.
Yeah.
Anytime I've dealt with somebody who has problems with the church, if they're willing to just do the research,
Yeah.
my rule of thumb, Dan, is all you do, you read whatever you want about the
Right.
church, good, bad, indifferent, doesn't matter. Tell me what it is, I'll read it with you, and then we'll just discuss.
Yeah.
And you know what? When they do that, they generally come back
Yeah.
because it stands and it speaks for itself, especially with the research and the things that we provide with Interpreter. Do I read every article every week? No.
Right.
But I know what's in them.
Right.
And some of them I do read, and some of them I read more than once.
Yeah. Yeah, I've thought that one of the functions I'd like us to do with short film projects, podcasts, and so on, is to alert people to the treasure trove of material that we've already amassed. I mean, it's
Yeah.
been, as you say, almost 14 years now of stuff. Some of the articles, may not be all that important anymore, but many of them are, and yet they're largely forgotten.
Yeah.
And so I want people to know. I mean, one of the things that you learn in as you're getting old is that things you thought were just a little while ago are actually a long time back. I'll think of a movie and think, gosh, that was what, 5 years ago? I think, no, it was 22
22.
years
Yeah,
ago or something like
exactly.
that.
Yeah.
And or issues that come up about warfare in the Book of Mormon. I'm thinking of a specific case where I said, well, we actually dealt with that in a book that we published with the Old Farms.
In
Well, it was published in,
1988,
yeah,
989, something like
Warfare
that.
in the Book
Warfare
of
in the Book
Mormon.
of Mormon. I've got it on the shelf.
And I thought,
Yeah.
well, we dealt with that. Okay, but this person was not born for another 15 years. He's never
Yeah.
seen the
And
book.
it's not really in print.
No. And so that's why it's important to get things online and get them out there so that they stay. Because, an LDS print run for a book is usually not very large, a few thousand.
Yeah.
And then it disappears and it's on some bookshelves in people's homes. And then they die and it's sent to DI or something like that.
Yeah.
But the book no longer has a real living presence in the community. But some of this stuff really needs to have that living presence. It
Oh,
needs to be
yeah.
remembered.
So having it online is great.
Yep.
Well, Dan, thank you for being with us. We've actually spent a little longer than we anticipated, but it's always a pleasure to be with you and to hear about your thoughts on Interpreter. Thank you for all of your work for all the rest of us. And we will, I'm sure, have you on again. And we'll talk about those favorite journal articles of yours
Okay.
off the
Yeah.
air
Yeah.
so
Well,
we can
thank you
get
for
started
having
on
me.
some of those. Yeah, this
Thank
has
you for
been a
having me,
real
and thank you for
pleasure.
doing this.
Good luck with the rest of the series.
Thank you.
We're looking forward to it. Thanks.
Great. Thanks.